From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A measure of normalcy has been returning to Greece, with the country's banks reopening after being closed for the past 21 days. Athens imposed controls to avoid capital flight. Those controls limit withdrawals by individuals to 420 euros per week. And the IMF issued a statement Monday that Greece was no longer in arrears in its payments to the fund, having made the 1.6 billion euro payment it missed on June 30th. Now that Greece has cleared its arrears, it's entitled to more loans from the fund. And on Friday, Athens received a 7.2 billion euro loan from the EU, the bulk of which it immediately used to repay its outstanding obligations, a precondition to the Greek government getting the three-year bailout plan it seeks that's worth up to 86 billion euros. Correspondent Konstantin Venizalos was in Athens Monday and spoke with Press TV's Wakar Rizvi about the changes expected to take place in Greece over the near term.
First, the reason why Greek banks have reopened today is because last week the Greek government legislated continued austerity in Greece, same as when just over 3 weeks ago, when the Prime Minister decided to hold a referendum against austerity, the banks were shut down by the ECB. Therefore, solvency and operation of the Greek banking sector is largely dependent, well, it's almost entirely dependent on the successful and continued implementation of Greece's new austerity program. We know that withdrawal limits are still in place, and there's very little that customers can do inside banks. For example, loan repayment is forbidden, except repayment via cash or money transfers from abroad, and they too are largely restricted. You can't really move any money in and out of the country at the moment. And there's also significant problems that have arisen in company orders and imports and exports in the country. Of course, today sees the gradual implementation of austerity in Greece. VAT on basic food went up today a whopping 10% to 23% across the spectrum of basic foodstuffs here in Greece. Back in 2010, under Greece's first memorandum, VAT on food went up to 11% from the pre-crisis 8%, and this morning it has gone up to 23%. So this is the conditionality, unfortunately, for the continued operation of the Greek banking sector, that austerity is incrementally and gradually has begun to be implemented here in Greece. But the implementation of this new austerity package here in Greece is problematic and questionable in both political and technical terms. Very briefly explain this. In political terms, Syriza is desperately at the moment looking for a mandate for continued austerity, both among its divided lawmakers and committee members, and of course among people who, 62% of Greeks voted against continued austerity back on July the 5th. And also in technical terms, both the IMF and the ECB are saying that explicitly now, they're saying they have actually concluded this, that despite the depth and extent of austerity continuation in Greece, the country's debt is unsustainable, non-serviceable, unless it is generously written off in coming weeks. Of course, within looming negotiations that are set to restart in coming days between Greece and the country's lenders. So while continued austerity is problematic, we are told by banking officials that, that normality today is restored. But as we've just explained, we don't believe that is the case.
As we reported last week, Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras reshuffled his cabinet Friday after facing some opposition among ministers and deputies from his ruling Syriza party over the new bailout package. The move was viewed as an effort by Tsipras to show Greece's creditors that he remains in control over his government. Among the new faces in the cabinet is George Katrogalos, the new Minister for Labor and Social Solidarity. From 2014 until his cabinet appointment Saturday, he was a Syriza member of the European Parliament representing Greece. In a conversation this past weekend, he said that the country faces challenging times, but he was optimistic that things will improve for people in Greece going forward. He has agreed to speak with us about the challenges his office faces, and some of the actions that are planned, and we'll bring you that conversation later this week. After 54 years, the Cuban embassy in Washington officially reopened on Monday, 7 months after Presidents Raul Castro and Barack Obama announced that the two countries would move to normalize relations. Cuba still insists that full normalization cannot occur until Washington's blockade against the country is lifted. Telesur's Cody Weddle spoke with journalist Catherine Murphy, who was at the Cuban embassy in Washington during the opening ceremony Monday.
It's been a very historic day. There were hundreds of people, both inside and out of the embassy today, to witness the raising of the Cuban flag here for the first time in over 50 years. Both Roberta Jacobson and Josefina Vidal were present, as well as representatives from many diverse sectors of U.S. society who have worked over decades toward normalization of relations. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez was also present, and they did a very solemn, serious, in the Cuban fashion, traditional raising of the flag with three uniformed, white uniformed soldiers marching out, standing and raising the flag. And in spite of all of the people that were around, it was a moment of like heavy silence and then a whole lot of cheering.
There are still some issues that remain to be solved between the two countries. What are those? Of course, among those is the economic blockade. And is there talk of that today, of those issues?
The December 17th announcement by President Obama and President Raul Castro that steps would be taken toward normalization marked a change in direction, of course, with U.S. policy. But there are many unresolved issues that need to be brought to the table. The reestablishment of embassies in the two different countries just says now the two countries are agreeing to sit down and talk. To use diplomacy to talk about our many differences. But the U.S. trade embargo, which Cubans call a blockade, is still very much in place. There are still restrictions on U.S. travel. There are only 12 categories of what they call, what the U.S. State Department and Treasury Department call purposeful travel, via which U.S. citizens can travel to Cuba. So the travel hasn't opened. Many people think, because they see all the headlines in the press, that, oh, everything is normalized, you know, quote unquote. But that is far from true. This is the first step. Of course, there have been multiple talks since the December 17th announcement. There have been multiple talks both in Havana and in Washington, where some of the main sticking points were brought to the table. One of Cuban's first conditions, really, for normalization was to be removed from the terrorist list. Cuba was removed from the terrorist list. Barack Obama suggested it. And in the absence of a massive, I think it's a congressional majority, it takes maybe a two-thirds majority to try to block it. The Congress did not have that kind of support, so they just didn't even try to fight it. So a month ago, Cuba was taken off of the terrorist list. There's still a lot to talk about. There's a lot to be worked out. But this is a major step forward and a wonderful day for both countries.
And Catherine, we had heard talk from some conservative lawmakers that they would at least try to delay the appointment of an ambassador from the U.S. What about those conservative lawmaker voices? Are they still raising their voices there today? And do they continue to try to, do they plan to continue to try to push back as the two countries move forward in normalizing relations?
There definitely were people of that perspective who were here this morning and were making their voices heard as well. But in terms of blocking an ambassador, the two countries have taken the decision that, at least for now, the current heads of mission on each side will be stepped up to charge d'affaires, and they will head up these new embassies for the time being until ambassadors can be named on each side.
Last week's agreement between the so-called P5 plus one countries and Iran was on the agenda at the United Nations Security Council Monday. The Council unanimously approved a resolution that creates the basis for international economic sanctions against Iran to be lifted.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2015/547 please raise their hand? The result of the voting is as follows. The draft resolution received 15 votes in favour. The draft resolution has been adopted unanimously as Resolution 2231, 2015.
The resolution, which is legally binding, lays out the steps required for the lifting of UN sanctions only. It has no legal impact on sanctions imposed separately by the US and the European Union. The EU also approved the deal on Monday, setting in motion the lifting of its own sanctions, which include prohibitions on the purchase of Iranian oil. The EU will continue both its prohibition of the export of ballistic missile technology to Tehran and the sanctions it says are related to human rights. Not everyone was happy about the deal.
Ladies and gentlemen, today you have awarded a great prize to the most dangerous country in the world.
That was Israel's permanent representative to the UN, Ron Proser, speaking at a press conference outside the council chamber after the vote. He was directing his comments to the members of the council.
I hate to be the one who spoils the party, but someone has to say that the emperor has no clothes. Today is a very sad day, not only for the state of Israel, but for the entire world. Even at this moment, the international community refuses to see the tragedy. It is a sad day because the international community is taking steps to lift the sanctions on Iran without first waiting to see if Iran complies with even a single obligation in the agreement. It is a sad day because this agreement gives Iran a seat on the commission which will decide whether or not it has violated the agreement. This is like allowing a criminal to sit on the jury which will decide his own fate.
Earlier, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sent a message to U.S. lawmakers in an attempt to try and convince them to oppose the deal with Iran, saying that the UN vote wasn't the last word. Netanyahu was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz as saying to a Likud faction meeting, quote, as long as the sanctions imposed by the U.S. Congress are in effect, Iran would have to make concessions, closed quote. Netanyahu's statement was aimed at lawmakers in both houses of the U.S. Congress, who will review the deal in the next 60 days. At the end of this time period, they'll vote on whether to lift the sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter arrived in Israel Sunday, bearing gifts, following an acrimonious conversation between his colleague John Kerry and the Israeli Prime Minister. Kerry, who related parts of that conversation in an interview with PBS last Friday, said Netanyahu's claim that a better nuclear deal with Iran could have been obtained was a fantasy.
We still believe that Israel will be safer with a one-year breakout for the 10 years than 2 months, that Israel will be safer with the insights we have into this program than without any, that Israel will be safer with a certainty that we prevented their pathway to a bomb rather than moving now to a conflict. Now, there's no alternative being provided by all these other people. They all say, oh, why didn't you crush them with the sanctions? I'll tell you why. Because they won't be crushed by sanctions. That's been proven. And because we'll lose the other people who are helping to provide those sanctions. They're not going to do that if Iran is willing to make a reasonable agreement. So there's a lot of fantasy out there about this, quote, better deal. The fact is that we spent 4 years putting together an agreement that had the consent of Russia, China, France, Germany, Great Britain, and Iran.
Last week, U.S. President Barack Obama offered to upgrade Israeli military capabilities as well as security and intelligence cooperation between Israel and the U.S. Netanyahu has since refused to discuss any such U.S. compensation, apparently believing it would weaken his position as he tries to rally congressional and U.S. public opinion against the deal with Iran. Nevertheless, according to various media reports, the Israeli military already has a shopping list. Carter is expected to discuss the wish list when he meets with Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon during the trip. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ghulamali Khushru, laid out his country's perspective for the Council.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Resolution 2231 that the Council just adopted represents a significant development and marks a fundamental shift in the consideration of Iran's peaceful nuclear program by the Council in the past 10 years. The JCPOA is the result of a series of extensive and collective efforts that sought for close to 2 years to give diplomacy a chance and end their resort to pressure, coercion, and threat. This fundamentally different approach, which was a departure from the past travel during the preceding years, helped all of us hope for the best possible way out, put an end to an unnecessary crisis, and accomplish major achievement for all the parties involved and the whole international community. The resolution that was adopted and the JCPOA that was endorsed today provided also for the termination of the Security Council resolution that unjustifiably placed sanctions on Iran for its efforts to exercise its rights. They were grounded on nothing but baseless and pure speculation and hearsay. Nobody has ever presented any proof indicating that Iran's program has been anything but peaceful. The IAEA that put Iran's facilities under a record inspection has consistently reported that Iran has dutifully stood by every single commitment. For example, in terms of inspection frequency, only Japan has been subject to greater scrutiny than Iran, while Japan has much more extensive nuclear facilities. Last year, Iran even surpassed Japan in the number of inspections. Therefore, the involvement of the Security Council was not caused by a suspicious nuclear weapon program, but driven by the stated objective in SCR 1696 to compel Iran to suspend its lawful enrichment program. That demand was not only unnecessary and uncalled for, but in fact ran counter to the unanimous conclusions of the 2000 and 2010 NPT review conferences, which stipulate that the choices of member states with regard to their fuel cycle activities must be respected. It also neglected the repeated demands of the majority of the international community represented in NAM. The sanction imposed against Iran in SCR 1737 through 1929 were all punishments for the refusal of the Iranian people to accept that demand. In engaging with ITRE/EU+3, the Iranian people have had the foresight to move forward without losing sight of the past. Therefore, while we hope that the Security Council will open a new chapter in its relations with Iran, we cannot accept or forget its previous treatment of Iran, starting from its inaction in the face of Saddam's aggression and the use of chemical weapons to its more recent treatment of the Iranian peaceful nuclear program. The solution that we arrive at is undoubtedly in the interest of strengthening the regime of nuclear non-proliferation in its entirety, as it includes and recognizes the right of Iran to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, including uranium enrichment activities and R&D on its soil. Rights and obligations of states parties to the NPT, as under any other international regime, can only go hand in hand. Obligations would be honored, and these regimes, including the NPT, sustain only if rights could also be achievable. No threats of sanction or war could help sustain the NPT in the long run if big powers fail to honor all its three pillars, including total nuclear disarmament and right of all to use nuclear energy. And non-parties are rewarded by their intransigence. Looking up to the future, my government hopes that the JCPOA and Resolution 2231 herald a new chapter in the relation between Iran with the Council and the JCPOA participants. Iran is both in a position and willing to comply fully with its commitment under the JCPOA because it is already committed to the fatwa of its supreme leader, who has declared all weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons, to be haram, and its defense doctrine also so requires. We hope that our partners, as well as the Council, do the same with regards to their commitments under the same documents. The desire expressed by the Council to build a new relationship with Iran, it's encouraging all member states to cooperate with Iran in the framework of the JCPOA in the field of peaceful use of nuclear energy and related projects, as well as its emphasis that the JCPOA is conducive to promoting and facilitating the development of normal economic and trade contacts and cooperation with Iran are all positive signs and all encouraging. Mr. President, while they still focus on the nuclear issue, Iran expects it to have a wider positive implication for our region and the whole international community, including the following. First, the deal which was sealed on this basis of mutual respect and understanding is an important achievement for diplomacy over pressure and coercion, and could produce nothing with regard to Iran in the past 37 years. It reinforces faith in diplomacy as the most rational way to resolve differences in our interconnected world, and shows that diplomacy can work and prevail over war and tension. It is therefore a clear message to those who still believe that they can achieve everything through force and coercion. Second, the JCPOA has the potential to help trigger a major development in this region towards more cooperation and coordination aimed at addressing the real issues at hand. Thus, we earnestly hope that it helps turn the page in our region, enabling countries to close the ranks and fight resolutely against violent extremism, and to move towards more cooperation to address the grave threats that our region and the world face. While all countries in our region have a very high stake in defeating terrorism, violent extremism, and sectarianism, the JCPOA participants are also facing similar challenges in their security from this phenomenon. With the dust settled over the nuclear issue, we are now free to focus on real issues and benefit from the better environment conducive to a wider cooperation among all actors. Third, in the wake of this major development in the region, we renew our call to our neighbors and friends in the Persian Gulf and the wider region that Iran is ready to engage in good faith with all of them based on mutual respect, good neighborliness, and brotherhood. We have many common challenges in our region to address and many common opportunities to benefit from. This is the time to start working together against our most common and important challenges, which includes, above all, violent extremism. Fourth, the Israeli regime, following its general policy to stoke tension in the region, has done whatever in its power to sabotage and defeat any effort towards resolving the standoff over Iran's nuclear energy program. In so doing, it proves once more that it does not see peace in our region in its interest and considers peace as an existential threat to itself. The Iranophobia that they try to spread in the region and beyond is also to serve this nefarious purpose. Thus, we alert our friends and neighbors not to fall into their trap. In this context, it is also not surprising that the Israeli regime is the only obstacle in the way of establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East that my country initiated more than 40 years ago and has ever since promoted. We believe that nuclear warheads stockpiled by the Israeli regime constitute a grave threat to peace and security in our unstable region. And the Security Council should live up to its primary responsibility under the UN Charter and take necessary action to neutralize this. Mr. President, let me recall that Iran, as a nation with a rich culture and civilization, has withstood enormous millennial storms while being steadfast in preserving its independence and identity. These have not been acquired through oppressing others or reneging on commitments. The steadfastness of our delegation showed during the negotiation stemmed from the fact that we only accept commitments that we can abide by. As Iran is resolute in fulfilling its obligations, we expect that our counterparts remain also faithful to theirs. Only through honoring commitments, displaying good faith, and adopting the right approach can diplomacy prevail over conflict and war in a world that is replete with violence, suffering, and oppression. In this context, the JCPOA provides a solid foundation for further and more effective diplomatic interaction. Before I conclude, let me thank those ambassadors who supported the JCPOA and also those countries who helped this deal happen. And also let me briefly react to some baseless accusations leveled by some members, some previous speakers. It is ironic that the distinguished ambassador of the United States accused my government of destabilizing the region and terrorism. The country that invaded two countries in our region and created favorable ground for the growth of terrorism and extremism is not well placed to raise such accusations against my country. Feckless and reckless acts of the United States in our region for so many years are at the root of many challenges that we are now facing in our neighborhood. Iran is a stable country in an unstable region. As we want our stability to persist, we do promote the stability in the region, and we help our neighbors to stabilize and cooperate toward this end. In conclusion, Mr. President, let me also inform you that my delegation, upon the instruction from my government, is forwarding the statement of the Islamic Republic of Iran following the action taken today by the Security Council to be circulated as a document of the Security Council. Thank you, Mr. President.
Israel's permanent representative sidestepped a question asked by a reporter outside the council about whether Israel, which is the only Middle East country to possess a nuclear weapons arsenal, would now be willing to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Ambassador, Iran has now joined NPT, well, was member of NPT, has joined the additional protocol based on this agreement. Is Israel ready to join NPT at least?
Well, let's look back and see, and Iran abiding by international agreements, the track record is not that good, and in the sense, let's make sure that this Iranian agreement is really done in a way that Iran will really it violated every single agreement up till now. I don't see it continuing to abide by anything because of its track record.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.